Welcome, everyone. On the podcast today, we meet Chase Eliason. Chase grew up racing at dirt tracks in the Midwest with ambitions to someday work for a top-tier NASCAR team. He attended Michigan Technological University starting in 2009 to obtain a mechanical engineering degree. During his time in college, he had internships at General Motors and Toyota. Both of these led to the dream internship at Hendrick Motorsports in 2012. Following his graduation in 2014, Chase was hired full-time as a race engineer at Hendrick Motorsports, assigned to the 48 team with Jimmy Johnson as the driver. He just finished his fifth full season with the team, and that included 13 victories and a championship in 2016. Chase hopes his story of dreaming big and working hard will serve as an inspiration to future engineers pursuing their dream careers. I'd like to welcome Chase to EYC. All right, everyone, welcome to the podcast. We got Brennan on the line. How you doing, Brennan?
Dude, I'm doing pretty good, Troy. How about yourself?
Doing really good, man. You know, the Thursday, I had some successes at work today, some failures, learned a little bit. I feel like it was, unfortunately, a typical day as an engineer where you're having successes, having failures, but hopefully learning from them. I don't know.
Maybe. I think it's probably different for you since you're technically in school now still.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know how you quantify what you do on a daily basis since you're getting your PhD, you're working on projects, but it's different. At least in my uneducated eyes, different than what you might be doing when you were working before.
Yeah, that's fair. I think we'll probably have a whole discussion on the PhD thing, but to me, the day-to-day is actually pretty similar. It's solving engineering problems. Maybe I just get paid less. I don't know. So kind of how it's
same work, less money. Nice.
Same work, less money. Somehow the system got that to work out, but that's all right. I don't know. You know, I think it's just kind of part of being an engineer.
We'll get through it. But hopefully our guest today does get paid for the work that he does.
Yeah. Yeah. So today we're talking to Chase. Really, really looking forward to this. I don't know, a lot of interest in what goes on in the NASCAR world. It seems really fascinating. But I think there's a lot of people out there that probably really don't know what NASCAR is. And so Chase, maybe to start, man, can you just kind of walk us through what is NASCAR?
Yeah. So NASCAR really stands for the National Association for Stock Car Auto Racing, really originated here in the United States and is about the premier series in the United States. Currently, they race about 38 races a year, and we race in West Coast, out in California, Phoenix, Vegas, all the way out on the East Coast, back where I am in North Carolina, race quite a bit around here. About 40 cars that follow the series on a typical weekend. Our last 12 events of the year. We're kind of like a playoff schedule, similar to a football, any other professional sport. And then we have a final championship race is our last race of the season. And basically it's four guys that are heads up. And then whoever wins that race wins the championship, basically.
Nice. So in NASCAR, Chase, what are the teams composed of? I don't really have a great idea of it because I don't necessarily follow NASCAR, but when we talk about racers and drivers and maybe the teams they're with, is that the right word? Can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, of course. So it's actually a lot more people that are involved in the sport than you probably imagine. You know, Hendrick Motorsports in particular is where I work for. And currently they employ 650 people just for four teams.
Wow.
So you have that ranges all the way from engineering. You know, you have a lot of mechanical engineering, some electrical engineering. You have vehicle engineering, which is specific to designing parts and testing parts. And then you've got race engineering, which is the side I'm on. And then you've got marketing, admin, engine engineering, machine shops, dynos. So we have kind of like a small little college campus at our headquarters here in Concord, North Carolina. A lot of people that go into making four cars go fast in a circle.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like it. In a really interesting environment and kind of like what you're talking about in like a sport team environment. I mean, from my understanding, right? I mean, this is a team sport. Like we're in it to win it. It's interesting to imagine that as the job. Does it feel like that? Like, I mean, I imagine in season, like when you're going to work, like you're going to practice, getting ready for the race.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's all 100% of a team sport. You know, there's 650 of us, but each individual team, you know, there's four car numbers at Hendrick. So there's 9, 24, 48, 88. And within those car numbers, we have a small group that's assigned just to that car number. And I'm on the 48 right now. And there's a group of about 15 of us. Between engineers, crew chiefs, over the wall guys, so like pit crew that change tires and do all that. And we become really close throughout the year. You know, you live basically on the road with those people for 38 weekends out of the year from February until November. So you become really close with them. You know, you see them more than you see most of your family. So you have to work really close. You have to have a lot of respect for each other. You know, there's times that there's frustration, but the best team that we've had probably since I've been working there was 2016, and just how we gelled and how everybody worked well together. And that is the year that we won the championship. So it's definitely a huge player in our sport. It's how well you can gel as a team and work together.
Do you guys feel like, even, I guess, from your perspective, can you have a good season even if the car you're supporting doesn't win? I mean, I guess I mean that from a technical side, but also then from the team side. Can you feel like, hey, our team, we did really good, but things just didn't work out and we're okay with that? Or does it kind of like if we don't win, that's always kind of a letdown?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of two-edged. You really go out to try to win races, and the ultimate goal is to try to win the championship at the end of the year. But at the end of the day, there's 40 teams and there's one car that can win the championship. And it's such a cyclical sport that, you know, you have one year where you're on top, just like any other professional sport. The next year you can be at the bottom. But I still think you can take a year where you struggle. This past year, for example, is the worst year of Jimmy Johnson's career ever. And I think at the end of the year, like he said, it's the best he's ever felt in a race car, you know, the last 8 races of the season. We didn't win any races. We weren't even in the championship hunt. But just his comfort level and just seeing improvements throughout the year and how well the team meshed and gelled together, I think we were all very excited to get into the 2020 season already. So yeah, you definitely can. From a technical standpoint too, you know, I think we made a lot of gains on our cars. We started the year off of what other competitors were. And I think from the engineering side, that's exciting because there's so much we can contribute to in the speed of the cars, whether that's body, whether that's engine, whether that's, you know, rolling resistance with powertrain components, whether that's shaving off, you know, an eighth of an inch of bolts, 10 bolts on the top of the car, just to try to lower the CG of the car. I feel like we really can have a hand in the outcome of the cars and how they perform. So that's exciting for us. And I think at the end of this year, we were really able to make gains on our cars and be competitive.
It sounds really interesting, Jay. I mean, I guess, well, first I want to jump back a little bit to this idea of like this team sport mentality. I mean, Brennan, I've never felt that in industry. Have you ever, like, I mean, I don't, I feel like a team, but I've never really felt like that kind of a team.
Not like that. I mean, I go to work with the same people every day and they're all around me and, you know, we work on the same thing and we're kind of a team, but not like that close. But I imagine that when you're on the road with these people for, you know, 30 some weekends out of the year, that you kind of get a whole different level of bonding. I feel like I've found that some ways when we've done like work trips at my job where it's like, oh, I get to know these people better and know them kind of outside of work context. But then it's going back to work, you know, the next week or whatever, and we're all back in our cubes.
Right. Yeah. It's fun because you get to go on the road with all these people and you stay in a hotel room and, you know, at night you work with them all day at the racetrack and that's great, but it's such a hot, you know, fast paced environment that you don't get to interact very often. But then you get back to the hotel room and you can go out to eat with them. You can go with there becomes little different cliques at times. You know, some people prefer going to these restaurants or that restaurant, but you can kind of float in between groups. You know, we all get along really, really well. No, I just went on a cruise last week with our truck driver and his wife on our team. You know, I just spent 38 weeks with him, 10 months out of the year. And I want to finish the season going on a cruise with him, and I had a blast. So
I've always loved that about work trips. Like this idea that, not the idea, but like the bond that you get. Cause even like having, you know, sharing a meal with someone, like you don't necessarily do that at work, right? Like you may, there's a good chance that if you just went to the office and that was your job, just always going to the office, that you wouldn't actually go like share a meal with someone.
Yeah.
And like just doing that kind of stuff, like it just brings out other things, right? It connects that way more. And I think for me, maybe it's just because my job or my previous job and things, maybe it's because the goal wasn't so clear. Like I feel like for you, Chase, like it's this, like win the championship. Like it's a lot more defined than maybe an engineer. Like what is the current goal? Make the product better. Run these TPA tests. You know, like it's maybe having that clear definition of this is the objective it almost speaks to leadership, like in that it gives you a direction, right? In the same way that maybe a good manager who sets a good vision does.
Yeah,
maybe.
Yeah, no, I agree 100%. And such a big part of our teamwork too is our crew chiefs basically lead the team. Per team, there's a crew chief, and they're typically engineers also. And they are the leadership and the gel that holds the team together. And they're the ones that try to give you a vision for the year and try to keep you motivated throughout the year. They're kind of the voice in your ear throughout the whole time. And we recently just got a new crew chief in July, I think it was this year. Young guy, he's 30 years old, engineer. Him and I actually started at the same time as race engineers on the 48. And that speaks volumes to how well we were able to mesh here at the end of the year, just having that leader with a vision, with the confidence. He believes in every one of his guys, and he tells us that all the time, and is quick to compliment us and is quick to point out what we did well, as well as try to point out what we need to improve on. So I think that is a huge contributor to our teamwork, is that leader, that crew chief. And I've had it before where it's been the opposite, and it's very obvious. We all feed off that leader, it seems like. The team goes downhill quick when you don't have a strong leader.
Yeah. So going from this team then that's got, I forget how many people you said, 20 people on your team, yeah, roughly. Let's take this down then to what do you do on a daily basis? What is your function within that team specifically?
Yep. So basically I've floated in a couple different positions over the last, I guess I'm going into my sixth season now. I originally started as a third race engineer. So basically each team has three race engineers. Then I went to a shock engineer, lead shock engineer on the 48, which is kind of a different subject. It's mostly damping and springs and all that. And then this year I just got promoted to second race engineer. But basically our jobs as race engineers is to provide support to the crew chief. So we dig through all the data. We've got several different simulation programs we run through, just on computer based. And then we also have a bunch of test rigs at the shop, and we can sort through data. We can go all through all kinds of stuff. Basically our goal is to try to come up with setups every week, try to optimize our chassis, try to optimize our engine packages, try to optimize our bodies. We dig a lot into the aero data. We go to the wind tunnel every week. I don't necessarily go to the wind tunnel, but we're looking through the data at the wind tunnel. Just trying to feed that data to the crew chief. And then the crew chief tries to make a decision based off of what we're recommending. It's kind of a small tidbit of what we do. Obviously we're involved in a lot. We also work a lot with the driver at the racetrack, because in NASCAR, you don't have any data acquisition on the car throughout a weekend. So we're basing all our decisions off of verbal from the driver.
Oh, okay.
He said the car's tight, if it's loose, if it's pushing, you learn their cues. I've been with Jimmy now for 5 full seasons, and I'm finally starting to figure out all. He's got code words for different things he's feeling in the car. And you can go back to a database that we have 3 years ago. It's like, oh, he said that here, and we tried this on the car, and it really helped or really woke up that area.
I think it's interesting, like, you have to convert that subjective, like this idea of you have to take words. I mean, I'm sure the drivers are really technical, probably, maybe not by training, but they end up getting there because they realize they have to get better. But this idea of like converting what they have into actual like engineering decision, like, okay, the car's feeling loose. Okay. I made some spring stiffness changes. Is it that, like, is it the stiffness rate on the rear shocks? Is that what I specifically need to change as the engineer to accommodate this? It's an interesting translation job.
It is. Cause you go into the sports like the F1 cars and the Indy cars, and they've all got live telemetry throughout a race. So they're looking at it and they're able to make adjustments on the fly based off just completely data driven.
Oh, wow. And then for those who don't know, telemetry meaning there's data acquisition on board that's being beamed to you guys who are stationary on the sideline. So you're actually looking at the raw data during the race. Is that what you mean for F1?
Yep. Yep. Exactly. Wow. Yeah. So we've got just recently, I guess this year, they came up with a new program called SMT, and it's basically a computer app where we can watch live. It looks like a video game where a car's on there and a car's got GPS, and it'll show us where our car is relative to everybody else. And then we can see simple inputs. So we can see throttle, we can see brake, we can see steering, speed trace, and RPM basically. And they allow that for all 40 teams, and we can see anybody else's too. So That's another tool that just recently became available to us as engineers. So we watch that a lot, and you know, we can see in steering traces if he's tight, if he's loose, where in the corner he's struggling. We do a lot of driver development with Jimmy. You know, I can say that I'm watching a specific car that's leading the race. We can provide him feedback and saying, hey, he's lifting earlier, he's using more brake into the corner, or we can see he's loose, but this seems to be helping him running higher or lower. So that's another tool that's brought a little bit more data-driven decisions, I guess.
Well, it sounds like maybe we should just step this out a little bit and let's talk about what, like, can you walk us through a race day? I mean, because it sounds like what you do on race day is similar, but what you're actually doing is significantly different than when you're in the office, obviously.
Correct.
So yeah, maybe just walk us through a day, like, and if you can kind of give us like examples of kind of like what you're talking about, like I'm looking at this and doing this, like, I'd love to hear that.
Yeah, so basically race day, honestly, from a race engineering perspective, is probably our easiest day of the week. Basically, when we come into the track on race day, our car is impounded. We've already gone through technical inspection. So there's not really anything we can do on the car side. Once the race starts, there's three of us engineers that sit up on the pit box. That's where the car comes in, gets tires and fuel and whatnot. We sit up there with our computers. We got a bunch of monitors that we watch. Once the race starts, which is shortly a couple hours after we get in the garage area, I've got that SMT app where I'm watching the data, where he's driving, his inputs. And then we're trying to take, the crew chief is talking to him the whole time over the radio and trying to get feedback from him, what the car is doing, what he's struggling with, what he needs help with. But from our engineering side, there's very few tools that we can adjust on the race car once the race has started. You know, we can adjust the rear jack screws in the car. We can adjust air pressures on all four corners, and we can adjust the right side track bar on the car. So once the race starts, we're trying to balance. We're talking back and forth with the crew chief throughout the race over an intercom and trying to determine what adjustments we need to make on a pit stop in order to try to improve the balance of the car. But if you're way off, it's difficult to try to get back on pace with the really fast guys because you've kind of made your bed once the race starts. And then also on top of that, you know, that's just setup specific. Then there's a lot of strategy. So we actually have a couple different strategy simulations we run where it says, hey, if you take right side tires here with this much lap time fall off, you're going to lose this many seconds over a run and you're going to lose this many positions as a result. If you take just fuel only, if you take four tires, depending on when you pit, you know, you can pit at different times, obviously, once your fuel windows open up. So there's a lot of that. And then the second part of that
is that you looking at that data,
yes,
feeding that feedback to the
to the crew chief. Yep, exactly. So we're looking through that data between us three engineers. It's majority of what I do and the primary engineer does. The third engineer just kind of supports a little bit on the side. So yes, we're feeding him that information, and then we're also scanning on a radio. We can scan the other 40 drivers.
Oh, interesting.
And we can try to figure out what they're doing. You know, basic, and they're doing the same thing to us. If they say over the radio, hey, we're going to pit in 10 laps, like we'll tell the crew chief, hey, the 18 car is pitting in 10 laps, or think about pitting, and hey, they're going to do tires. But teams have gotten, you know, tricky with that too, where they got code words. So they're saying, hey, we're going to take
10 means I'm pitting in 15.
Yeah. That, or they say we're pitting in 10 and they say, come in for M&Ms. Well, you don't know what M&Ms is. That might be four tires, might be two tires, it might be no tires. So, and they change them every week, and we do the same thing. So we kind of try to trick each other a little bit on strategy, because that's big.
Well, it's sports, man. It's like in football when you're covering your face when you're talking about the play. Like it's,
yeah, exactly.
It's an same interesting thing. Very interesting mold of technical engineering.
Yes, with
a fun sport.
Yes, it is. And then on top of that, I guess I run a fuel mileage program. So again, we can't see live fuel mileage on our cars. So we basically have a fancy Excel spreadsheet that we run, and it imports lap times and basically predicts how much fuel you have left. And you just weigh the fuel cans after each stop, so you know how much you got in the car. So we can usually predict within, you know, a quarter of a lap or half a lap when we're going to run out of fuel. So that, again, we're always talking to the crew chief about, hey, we got 10 laps left. Hey, we're not going to make our window. Consider pitting early. Consider staying out later when everybody else is pitting for strategy. So you're kind of trying to balance, you know, the race strategy with those programs with what you have available for fuel. sometimes you want to stretch your window out and you're trying to run as long as you can. Sometimes you're short pitting, just kind of depends on the track and the distance and what you're trying to do for points. You know, there's points in each, they basically, the races are broke up into stages, three stages. So like the first quarter of the race, and then they throw the checkered flag and that's, you get points, the top 10 get points. And then the second half, I guess, another 100 laps or whatever, that's second stage, top 10 gets points. And then the last stage. So that also adds to the strategy on when you want to pit and if you want points or not, or if it's worth foregoing points to try to finish the race better at the end. So it
sounds like you, unlike maybe what other professions are doing, you're making a lot of like decisions, you know, you have to be looking at data, making decisions right away. Like what you're looking at and analyzing now is going to have an immediate impact on, you know, whether the car pits now or later, or what you're trying to do for strategy. So it's almost like much more real time than what we might see in other disciplines where things are on much longer time horizons.
Yeah, correct. That's just specific to race day, obviously. You know, during the week, we predict, we're building cars right now for Daytona, which is 3 months away. So that's a little bit farther out. But yes, race day, it's last. You know, there's times that we're coming down pit road and we're communicating to the crew chief. We're, you know, 5 seconds away from our box and we're changing our mind what we want to do for tire strategy. So it's very on the fly at times, depending on what other people are doing and what we're, the data we're getting.
Yeah. So to maybe expand that then into less chaos, maybe like I'm interested. It sounds to me, so there's in season and off season from my understanding. And I assume that even not race day, but the difference in your day to day between those two seasons is drastically different. Is that true?
It is true. Yes.
Yeah. So maybe we should start by talking about like a typical day while you're in season, but it's not a race day. You know what I mean? Kind of walking through maybe like a few days before the race, what you're doing, what's going on. And if you have maybe like examples of like what specifically you'd be working on.
Yep. So typically we fly out, just to give you kind of an overview, during the season, we fly out on a Thursday night and we're back typically on a Sunday night. So we're in the shop Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. Supposed to have Mondays and Thursdays off, but typically are working those days. Typically Monday, we're wrapping up our post-race notes. So that's basically going through all our entire weekend, trying to get good notes, good documentation for the next time that we go back to that track. Tuesday mornings, our driver, Jimmy, actually comes into the shop and we do a full sit-down debrief with him where we'll go through every step of the race, every adjustment we made, what he felt on right side tires versus four tires, just try to break down the race, just try to get in our notes for the next time we go back to that track. Cause otherwise you forget so much, you know, 6 months later when you go back to that track. And then from there, that kind of wraps up the previous week. And then usually Tuesday afternoons, you're moving on to the next week's race. So that includes, we're starting to sift through data, set up data, trying to optimize our bodies. You know, our car is actually getting put together at that point, assembled during the week on Tuesday, Wednesday. So we're going through with the crew chief. We actually have a 4-hour meeting with him on Wednesdays, and that goes through every step of the race car, you know, from the front of the car to the back of the car, aero, basically any all encompassing, and trying to, that's usually where we make small decision changes. You know, we might change a spring, we might change some camber in the front, we might change a component here and there, but basically the car is built at that point. So once we get through that long discussion, it's us three race engineers and the crew chief. We kind of get notes for the weekend, what we want to try, kind of directions we want to go. From then we start sending out build sheets 2 weeks prior to the event. And specifically on the 48, I send all the build sheets for the cars. So really we're trying to forecast 2 weeks ahead of time. And we're sending out what chassis we want to run, what body spec we want to run, every suspension component, every interior item, seats, basically anything that bolts the car. I send a sheet out to everybody in the shop 2 weeks prior with help from the other race engineers. And then that car starts getting built 2 to 3 weeks ahead of time, typically. And then from there, you know, that's typically Wednesday afternoons that we send out the build sheet for 2 weeks out. And then Thursdays, usually you're diving into simulation, where you take whatever packages you want to try, or if there's new ideas you have, you run it through a computer simulation, see what it does, see if it's a direction you want to go. If it's not where you want to go, we also lay out what those practice changes entail. You know, if it's a right rear spring, if that's changing your height, if it's changing your wedge, we kind of write that all down and get it recorded. So when we're in practice, because again, that's fast pace at the racetrack, we're trying to do these changes in minutes. So that's probably a pretty typical week at the shop for me.
Wow. So to summarize, like there's so much diversity there in just a typical week. It sounds like Monday's documentation. Tuesday, we got like technical discussions. Wednesday is paperwork. And then Thursday's R&D. And then the weekend is the chaos of racing.
Yeah. Right. Right. You're trying to do all your prep work you can, you know, at the shop. We always say that you're 95% of the time your fastest race car is when you unload off the truck, you know, because you've spent weeks preparing this car. And we try practice changes and we try different packages, but it very often you go back to what you started with.
So what does, I mean, that's a lot going on during the race season then. What does it look like in the off season for however long or short that time may be? Are you guys doing more, I mean, kind of more R&D work almost to look at like longer and larger improvement projects or trying to test the car more? Like, I don't know, do you guys go back to different racetracks? Can you race in them or do you have your own track or what kind of goes on during that time frame, I guess?
Yeah, so really NASCAR is kind of mandated where we can't go test at a racetrack anywhere unless it's a NASCAR test. So typically there's only two or three tests a year and they almost never fall in the off season. It's almost during the season always. So at track, we can't do a lot. Off season in general, we do a lot of R&D work, like you said. So we're trying to improve our product for the following year. Like for example, this year we're getting a brand new body from Chevrolet. So we're spending a lot of time in the wind tunnel. I think we have like, in the month of December, I think we're there like 20 days oh, wow. or something. And they work 14-hour shifts there. Just trying to optimize this body as much as we can. So that's just a small example. We're involved a little bit in the body builds. You know, we try to dissect that information and try to create a build that we want in our bodies. We also have a 7-post at the shop, it's called. And basically what it is it's got 4 actuators under the tires of a full-blown race car. And then it's got 3 hydraulic rams that are attached to the bottom of the car that simulate downforce from aero. And basically we have a track file that'll run for each track. So the car bounces it around like it's at, for example, Daytona. The car will make a lap, bounce around like it's on Daytona. It's got sensors. It's fully sensored. It's got lasers and potentiometers and steering sensors and whatnot. So then we can sift through that data and then we can go out there. We can change a shock and then run another lap, look at that data and say, hey, what did that do? So we do a lot of that 7-post testing. We also have several other rigs that we can do, you know, suspension testing with. We got chassis dynos that we do powertrain efficiencies with. We do a lot of R&D trying to improve the product that we just ended on. And then we're also trying to forecast out, you know, we just finished today trying to forecast our chassis for next year. So we go ahead and we look at the 38 races that we have next year and we say, hey, we've got 12 different chassis we can run. How can we make it work where we run one this week and then it's a 6-week turnaround to get the car back on track? Where are we going to run it 6 weeks from now? And you have different chassis for different types of tracks. You know, you have a speedway chassis, a road course chassis, a short track chassis. What else am I missing? I think that's about it. And intermediate, which is a majority of our season.
Wow. Yeah, no, that's interesting. I think maybe just to help kind of the listeners understand, can you just pick like maybe one thing, and if you can't talk about it, like what you're doing right now, that's fine. Maybe like pick a thing from last season or something that you worked on and like kind of walk us through like what you were actually doing. Like the goal was to improve this. And so these are the things I did, you know what I mean? Just to kind of help everyone understand like what you might actually be working on technically or not technically in the off season.
Yeah. Yeah, so a project that I had, it was actually last off season. The crew chiefs had determined and drivers that they thought we had too much movement with the front of our car, basically, too much oscillation. So they wanted to try to calm that down. So we actually went to, I was one of the engineers assigned to that project. So we went to that seven post rig that I was telling you about where the car just bounces around like it's on the racetrack. And we played with different damping and then different springs and wheel rates to try and calm that down as much as we could. So, you know, that included going and making a change on the rig, going back, looking at the data, trying to find a clear direction. And you can spend, you know, we spent probably 3 days on the rig straight, you know, 3 9-hour days of just making changes, and trying to take an engineering approach to find what's best in each area and try to combine those together to improve our splitter control. You know, it's so big. We run our cars so low to the ground at the racetrack right now that you try to keep it on the ground, but you don't want it hitting the ground because it starts taking load off the front tires. And from an aero standpoint too, aerodynamics, you want the car to be as steady state as you can all the way around the racetrack. You know, perfect world, you'd have the car not move. You'd have really, really stiff chassis springs basically and not move at all. But then you become grip limited where they can't drive the car. So that obviously is impossible. But yeah, so that was kind of a fun project. And we incorporated a lot of those ideas into our setups this year. But there's still room for improvement. We actually have another test scheduled a couple weeks from now to kind
of build on that. Okay, so let me try to digest that, I think, for the listeners. So like on like a seven poster day, that's you starting out the day, you know, 9 hours, you're getting in. What time are you getting in?
6:30.
Okay, you're in at 6:30. There's probably a tech running the rig, right? Correct. And you're saying, hey, we're going to run this track profile with this vehicle. And then you run it. And they're like, okay, we got to make these adjustments. So you or a different tech is going out to the vehicle and actually physically turning the things, tightening stuff up, doing stuff.
Correct.
And then, okay, the adjustment's made, get back in the control room of the rig, hit go again on the play button, record the data, sit there for a second while you, I assume, look at the data and say, okay, it made this change.
Yep.
Process that with your engineering mind and say, okay, I want to now try this. Is that pretty much?
Yep. Yeah. You decide if you want to go further that direction or if that direction didn't work, if you need to make a change, a different change.
Okay. So supporting it from like an experimental way that way, but then also using your simulation tools where you can to essentially try to limit the amount of testing that you have to do. Meaning like, yeah, maybe you had a simulation that said, if I tighten it, it should go this way.
Correct.
And so it pushes you that way.
Yeah, it's about that seven pulse is about as real world as we can get, you know, without being on the racetrack. Because it's difficult. Our computer simulation tools are a little bit limited, you know, on stuff like tire squish. You know, obviously a spring rate of a tire gets squished, obviously, through load. And some of our tools don't do a super good job at that, modeling that.
Yeah.
So on the seven pulse, it's physically actually happening. So it's as
interesting,
as real as we can get without being on the racetrack.
And so you're dealing with these types of projects where it's like, hey, we have an objective. We have this issue or this thing we want to improve. And so then you're going out and you're helping, you know, with support of everyone else on the team, running it, trying to figure out how you can move the needle and then bringing that back in a meeting. Yeah. I assume it's then from that seven poster, are you compiling a presentation and bringing that presentation to a conference room and saying, here's what I found. Is that the next step?
Yep. So basically, as you go through that seven post, you're taking notes the whole time and you kind of compile a report at the end and then you send that out to all four teams. But we really only present it to our team. So my crew chief is who I would present it to. Go to him, say, hey, these are our findings. This is what we found was a good direction. He always wants to see the data because he's an engineer also. So you pull up the data, go through the data, you know, step through a couple different things you did, a couple different directions. And he may provide feedback and say, hey, I want to try more of this, or I want to try something different. Hey, did you think of this? And then we can go back to the seven posts and finish up his request. But yeah, once he looks it over, then he kind of decides if it's something we want to incorporate in the car or not. He has a final say, obviously.
So you're doing a lot of chassis and body work. Are you doing engine work also? Is that another team, or does NASCAR have that locked down for race teams?
They don't have it locked down. We have an entire engine department. We're not very involved from a race engineer standpoint. We're not very involved in the engine side. There's actually a whole separate group. I think there's 15 engineers that work just in engine engineering. So that's kind of a separate entity.
Okay. So they just give you weights and CG?
Right. And we understand that the horsepower implications. And sometimes they come out with new packages and they'll let us know, you know, from a high level view, we are aware of what's going on in the engine side, but not directly involved in the design and testing of.
Okay. Engine. So it's that's a different subsystem. You guys are not worried about it. Is the engine team there also then on race day, or are you guys the main support team for the driver?
We are basically the main support team for the driver. So from the engine perspective, we do have an engine tuner that is assigned to each race car. So they know the engine very, very well. And they're with each specific team. And they're the ones that'll go change valve springs or check lash, or, you know, it's become so electrical now. They got to connect to the car after every run and pull the data from it, the limited data we can get. So we do have some representation from engine throughout the weekend. But as far as like engineering side on the engine side, they only work in the race shop. They don't.
Okay. You guys are the people there on race day, supporting everything, making sure it all goes well.
Correct. Yeah. And if we have a major issue, then we have to reach back to somebody at the shop if it's something we can't solve.
Nice.
It sounds so, you know, just tying it back to like my world, you know, as a PhD student, it's like, I go, and I'll set up a plan and I'll run out and I'll do testing. And then I'll come back and my PhD advisor will say, okay. Yeah. You know, you might've done this wrong, or maybe we should do this differently. You know, it's so interesting how it's similar. You know, I imagine many of the engineers listening, like it's probably similar for them too. You know, especially if they're in the data acquisition realm, or even if they're in the modeling realm, where it's this idea of, hey, go model this thing, try to simulate this, bring the report back. It's just in kind of a different world.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
So you've been doing racing for 6 years now, right?
Correct.
Okay. So I guess going back before you were doing this, take us back kind of to how you even got to where you're at. Is this, I mean, even going back to maybe if you were a kid, was this something you knew you wanted to do before you even started going to college or anything? Or is this something you kind of figured out as you went through education and found out about the opportunities and what was there?
You know, it honestly had been a dream of mine since as young as I can remember. I was always a NASCAR fan growing up, and my family was very involved in dirt track racing, actually up in Minnesota. So from a young age, I was brought up around the racetrack. I spent a lot of time at the dirt track. I raced myself for 2 years. I worked for a dirt late model team that traveled nationwide when I was in high school. I did that for a year. I worked for a Dodge Viper race team that was in my hometown. I did that for a year. I traveled. And that travel was like 6 or 7 races a year, so it wasn't super intensive. But from a young age, I was always trying to build my resume to get to this point. So once I went to college, I had a very clear direction that I want a mechanical engineering degree to get into NASCAR. The end goal was to always work for Hendrick Motorsports. I didn't think I would ever start there. You know, in 2012, I guess, I had started putting my resume out there. I must have been a sophomore at the time. To any team, you know, to lower level teams, to lower budget teams, just to try to get my foot in the door, willing to work for whatever, free. Reached out, probably sent my resume to 30 different shops. And of course, the only company that got back to me was Hendrick Motorsports, which is weird how it worked out. So they called me, I had an interview with them. And I guess before that, I had an internship with General Motors and Toyota. I actually had a co-op with. So they called me randomly when I was at Toyota at the time doing a co-op. So I'd already been out of school for 6 months or something. And they said, hey, we want to offer you a job, did an interview or whatever. They said, are you willing to do a year internship with us? I was like, oh my gosh. At that point, I was going to be out of school for whatever that is, 15 months or almost 2 years, basically. So I was a little nervous about the time, but it was an opportunity that I really couldn't pass up. So I went and did that in 2012 through 2013. And then I went back to tech. I finished my mechanical engineering degree in December of 2014. They had sent me an offer, I guess it was maybe August of 2014, a full-time offer. And I started the second of January, I think, 15, right out of college.
So how does the bachelor's degree in mechanical engineering fit into this? I'm just curious, like now that you have your kind of experience, is it just kind of a check mark that has to happen along the way? Because it sounds like there was so much more that you were doing when you were a kid and all those other things.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly is a check mark that has to be checked in order to get the job. But I think there's a lot that I took away from college. You know, I just had one of my college professors from Tech send me notes from my vibrations class just last week, some slideshows. So the vibrations classes, the fluid dynamics classes for any of our aerodynamic stuff, I think that's all applicable, and just to have the mindset to understand the physics of the race car and what's happening, that the college degree was super important. From a, you know, work perspective, I think having the racing experience is really big. You know, when I look at a lot of resumes now, and we hire quite a few interns, and that is probably one of the biggest things we look for. You know, GPA isn't so important to us. The hands-on experience, and that doesn't even have to be racing. You know, if it's somebody working in their dad's garage all growing up, you know, putting brakes on cars or pulling engines out of cars, or they've got their own car that's kind of their hobby, that hands-on is really, really difficult to mesh the engineering side and the hands-on side. Is really important in this role.
So just to kind of summarize what I'm hearing, it's like there's a lot of different kind of boxes and things that are looked at. The bachelor's degree is one of them, but there's also a lot more that needs to fill out that person, or that not needs to, but that can fill out the person, that you guys are to the point where that's where you're looking, because there's enough people doing all that other stuff and that right. want to do what you guys right. are doing.
And there's a spot for people that are, you know, there's kind of two types of different engineering. You can go into design engineering and you can sit at a desk and design parts all day and work on, you know, a design software or run FEA, which is great. There's a need for those people. And we have a really good group of those people at our shop that do that every day. And then you're on the race engineering side, which is way more hands-on. You know, we're out getting, I'm laying under the car throughout the weekend and changing springs if I need to, or helping change a rear end housing, or helping change an engine. We're definitely probably 30% of my job is hands-on. I'm out at the car helping the guys out as much as I can. And I think that gives you a better understanding, you know, when you're making setup changes and you're trying to help our design department build something. Me being able to physically touch the car and understand the car, I think is big, because it's one thing to be able to design something behind a computer, but in order to integrate it into the vehicles, different story sometimes.
So it sounds like, Chase, when you were younger, you had this moment where you're like, I could be a race engineer. I mean, maybe it was a period of time, but at some point, obviously, you had this moment where you're like, this is a path I could go down. Do you remember when that was, how old you were, and like how you figured out what you needed to do to get there?
Yeah, it was probably, you know, I always wanted to work in racing. I think I knew that from a very young age. But it probably was when I was, I don't think it was an exact moment, but my junior year of high school, when I went and worked for that Dodge Viper race team, and I was able to go travel a lot and be able to do it for a living. And I think part of it also was me racing. You know, I raced myself for 2 years. And after that, I was 17 years old at the time. I said, man, this isn't the path I want. Like, I enjoy racing, but I want to be able to make a career out of it. And there's such a small percentage, like in any professional sport, to make it to the top, you know, as an athlete is very difficult. So that's probably 16 or 17 is when I decided race engineering is what I really wanted to do.
So how did you, I guess, figure out what you needed to do to get there? You know, I guess maybe for people out there that might be a junior in high school that are like, this is something that I want to do, but what advice would you give them on figuring out what to do to get there? Because I mean, I get your point about, you know, it's a percentage chance, it's small, but here are the things you should do to try to give it your best shot.
Yeah, for sure. You know, like I said before, I think the biggest thing to anybody that wants to get in the sport that's young is to try and get as much hands-on experience as you can get, whether that's working in with your dad at the garage, if that's going to a local racetrack and offering your help for free. You know, I did that for 10 years at my local racetrack. Coming out to North Carolina, you know, was big for me when I was younger. You know, I was in college. I flew out here and I just went and visited the shops. I literally called to originally set up with Hendrick. I called the 800 number online and the gift shop answered. And that was my first contact with Hendrick Motorsports. And I just started at Raw and I just said, hey, can you connect me with Human Resources? And went to Human Resources and started sending my resume, and just persistence. You know, I think I probably sent my resume for a year and a half before I ever got a call that there was a potential opening for an internship. So I think as much hands-on experience as you can get, you know, it always helps to know somebody within the sport. I didn't at the time, but that's how a lot of people get into it, is they know an engineer that works for a team, or they know a crew chief. It helps to have a foot in the door for sure.
So you're based in North Carolina now. Are all the race teams there? It means Hendrick's there. Are all the other teams based there, or is there kind of a larger geographic diversity of where the race teams are based out of? If someone was like, well, you know, North Carolina, I don't necessarily want to move there, but maybe there's something closer to home, or is it kind of, if you don't go, you don't have a chance.
It's kind of, if you don't go, you don't have a chance right now. You know, as of 2 years ago, there was a team out in Colorado, very successful, and they just shut down at the end of last year. So all teams are in North Carolina right now, probably within a 2 hour radius of each other.
Wow. Are you bumping into like other teams outside of work sometimes? Are you guys patronizing the same restaurants and hangout spots and everything else?
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, we see them all the time. Like, we'll go to lunch at work and we see people, you know, even within around Hendrick, probably within 5 miles, there's three or four other race shops. So even just going for lunch at work, you see other people.
Yeah, I don't know if you knew this, Chase, but I actually worked at Roush for the last 3 years before I came back to do work on my PhD. I didn't work for Roush Fenway. I didn't work for the race team. I worked in the consulting engineering wing.
Okay.
And so I was doing noise and vibration consulting, and we were in Detroit, and, you know, I typically work for companies, but I had a company that I had to work for down in North Carolina. And I remember I was in North Carolina walking downtown, and I had my Roush shirt on, and it's like a different thing. Like, you work for Roush, like, right. You know, in Detroit, no one has any idea. I mean, really, who Roush is for the most part. But like, you go down to North Carolina and you have like, you know, an official, like what looks like an employee jersey. I'll call it a jersey.
Right.
And it, you know, people comment on it. They'll stop you on the street and talk about it.
Right. Yeah. That's always been my thing. I'm the total opposite when I go, for that reason. If I go out at night, or if I go, you know, go get dinner and a drink or something with a friend, like, I will never wear anything that says Hendrick on it ever, whether it's a hat or a shirt, or for that reason. I don't want to be bothered outside of work.
Sure. Yeah. I think that's hard. And I'd love to tie this into family a little bit, if you don't mind, man. And it seems like it's so engulfing. I mean, even just talking about what you're talking about with just the travel commitment, I'm curious as to your perspective on how it works as a family to be a part of this team.
Yeah, for sure. It definitely is taxing on families. You know, thankfully, I guess I'm single now and don't have any kids. So that makes it easy for me at my age to be able to travel and go everywhere. So it's not so big of a deal for me, but I currently do work with a lot of families, a lot of people that have families. And it is extremely taxing, especially if you're in like that crew chief role. You know, they work 7 days a week, 10 hours a day. They're completely consumed in meetings and flying here and flying there. And it's difficult, but a lot of race engineers, you know, after typically they'll travel for 10-ish years and then they'll come off the road and get a shop job. So there's a lot of opportunities within like Hendrick. If I wanted to come off the road this year to be able to be a race or not a race engineer, but an engineer within the shop doing something different, whether that's testing, whether that's going to the wind tunnel, whether that's helping with CFD work. That's typically the people that start having kids and they travel for a couple of years. It's typically what they do is start transitioning to working in the shop.
Are there a lot of people then who have made a lifetime career out of working for Hendrick? Or is it, hey, I've been out traveling, now I transitioned to the shop, and now is there a lot of kind of attrition after that where people want to go try something else? Or is it like, I'm in this, I'm glad to be a part of it, I'm staying here until I retire?
I would say there's more people that are very committed to the company. You know, Rick Hendrick, who owns the company, is a huge family guy. You know, he's got a really strong Christian foundation. He's got a family of his own. He actually, in 2004, one of his private jets went down with his son in it and his two nieces, and they all passed away. And Rick has always preached family and being together and working together. He comes in all the time and he'll shake your hand. You know, he's a billionaire. He owns 150 dealerships or something in the nation. But he is so big on family that I think once people come off the road, people want to work there forever because of Rick. Rick, I think, is kind of the glue to this company. You know, he's been the spearhead since 1984, I think the company started. At 25 years, you know, every year they have a 25-year celebration, I guess. And it's recognizing people that have been at the company for 25 years, and he gives them all Rolex watches. And it's crazy to me every year that it's like there's, it seems like there's 10 people walking across the stage every year getting the Rolex watch, being there for 25 years. So I would say a lot more people stay than leave. You know, there is some turnover, obviously, just the nature of the business and competition, but
is that pretty unique, a lot of lifers do you think, to Hendrick Motorsports, or do you think some of the other race teams kind of have a similar culture, or at least a similar retention rate?
I think some other teams, some of the bigger teams have a similar retention rate. You know, the teams that have smaller budgets, I guess, definitely have a lot more turnover. You know, people are, and I think part of it is they can't attract the talent that the bigger companies can just because they can't afford it. And then those people just start bouncing all over the place and they go from team to team. You know, it's kind of fun to watch when you show up in Daytona every year in February. You're like, hey, I know that guy. He worked on the whatever 20 car last year. Hey, I know that guy. He's on a different team this year. Every year when you walk into Daytona, it's like, man, he's wearing a different jersey or a different shirt, whatever.
So, do they have rules on that? I think from my understanding, like on the West Coast, some of the West Coast companies, Facebook and Google and stuff, they almost have agreements to not poach employees. I don't know if that's true.
Yeah, there is to a point. So as a race engineer, there's a certain amount of people that are under contract. Like I'm a contract employee. So I just re-signed one for another 2 years. And my contract states, yes, that I can't go work. Under that contract, I can't go work for another company. And then after that contract is done, I still have to wait 8 months to go work for any kind of competitor. So they kind of got me locked down where I can't. If I want to get out of Hendrick, I would have to go work somewhere else for a year and then try to go to a different race team. As an engineer, you know, a general mechanic and, you know, body guy and fabrication guy, they are not contract employees, but the people that basically get to see all the data and know the insides are typically contract employees and kind of locked down.
Yeah, I think there's some things like that. I don't know. I mean, Brendan, you work at General Motors. Do you know if there's a similar thing for you? You probably can't. Can you go to an OEM? You probably have some kind of rule like that, or is that not true for you?
No, I don't think there is necessarily anything straight up. I guess I haven't tried to go that route yet, but I know there are people who have come directly to GM from other companies or have gone from GM to other OEMs. So I'm not sure. I should probably figure that out for my own sake of understanding what I've signed up to when I work for a company. But I don't know of anything like that.
What, you didn't read that packet of information when you started? Yeah, it's like,
man, I read some of it. I know there's definitely things I can and can't say. But I don't know. Shame on me.
Yeah, I'm the same way. I barely know. You know, I just got my third or fourth contract. I don't think I've ever read through the whole contract. I just kind of take for granted that what I'm signing is okay.
Sure. Well, I mean, we all like to think that everyone, I don't know, you know, people are good people. And, you know, if you're
right,
hoping you're working for a good company that's not just trying to win the championship in your case, but make the widget and others,
right,
or whatever.
Right.
So I just have like kind of one last question for you, Chase. And that's really to the person out there listening that, you know, is thinking like, man, it seems like something I'd want to do, you know, kind of in that was in maybe your shoes before. Like, what are the biggest differences than what you thought life would be like? You know, if you could talk to yourself when you were, you know, even say, and even before, you know, you're at Toyota and you know, you're just about to start the internship at that point, how is it different than what you would have expected it to be like?
Man, that's a loaded question.
Yeah, I know. I don't mean it necessarily like that. You know, it's just more like, it may not be that different, but you know, maybe I was just curious if there are actually some things that are like quite a bit different than you actually thought it would be.
Yeah, I think really probably the biggest difference for me is once I was here, not ever understanding how much went into it before I started working here. You know, how many people are involved, how much teamwork is involved, how much engineering goes behind these race cars to make, you know, you hear so often that these cars, they're just big blocks that turn left around the racetrack, and there's so much more behind it than I ever imagined. So many more people, it takes so many people to make it happen, and such an infrastructure to do it. And it's extremely rewarding too. You know, it's easy to imagine, you know, as a 10-year-old, what standing in victory lane as a champion down in Homestead would be like. And until you get to that point, it's, you know, you got to pinch yourself sometimes. Even 5 years into it, when I go into work, it's like, man, I'm working on one of the greatest NASCAR drivers ever to step into a race car. I'm working on this car every day. Like, it's awesome. very rewarding and challenging. But from an engineering side, that's fun for me.
Yeah, Chase, it sounds like you've got a pretty good setup there, and everything you've explained to us sounds like you almost got the luck of the draw. You've been working here right out of college, getting to do something you love, doing awesome stuff every day. Do you have anything else before we close it out that you want to share with anyone listening? Any maybe last minute advice?
Yeah, I would just say for the person out there that wants to follow the path, you know, I think more than anything, hard work will get you anything you want. I've always said that. You know, I wasn't the smartest person through college. My first semester at Tech, I was a 2.5 GPA, and I questioned myself if this was the path that I needed to be on. And I think with persistence and hard work, and it's the same way now, like I feel like I have to work 3 times harder than somebody else to learn something. But I think you can get anywhere if you work hard enough and you set your mind to it, regardless of how book smart you are, regardless of how much racing experience you have. And you just got to go after it. There was times that I never thought I would get into the sport, never be at the top tier that I'm at now. And you just got to keep pushing. Hard work works.
Yeah, that's some pretty good advice, Chase. Well, thanks for coming on the show and talking to us. It's been great talking to you and learning about what you're doing at NASCAR and everything. And yeah, we hope that you get to stand up there and get your Rolex too, and that the journey to get there goes really well. So thanks for coming on the show.
I appreciate it, guys. Take care.
Yeah, thanks, Chase. I realize that I think Jimmy's last season is coming up.
It is. It's 2020, is it?
Yeah, best of luck in the last season, man. Hope you guys do great.
Thank you. Appreciate it, guys.
Chase has got some pretty cool stuff going on for, you know, getting this job right out of college and working at it for 6 years, and like he's like achieved his dream. I think that's a pretty impressive thing. Like I'm still not there.
Yeah, it's really awesome, man. I'm really happy for him. You know, it sounds like he's worked his butt off and he's done a lot of stuff to really align him on this path. And I really couldn't be more happy for him.
Yeah, I think one of the big things I took away was how he prepared for this, how he kind of knew what he wanted to do. He had the vision of it and he worked at it high school up through college, even when he wasn't the best in school, like he said, but he put himself out there. He cold called the gift shop.
Volunteered for 10 years at the track.
Yeah. Yeah. Having that vision definitely can kind of help anyone, I think, get to where they want to go if they have a clear picture of that. That isn't to say that people who don't have a super clear picture of what they want to do can't get there. I don't think that's the case at all. I think people can fall into their dream jobs in all kinds of different ways. But when someone knows exactly what they want to do and kind of has a laser focus on it, it makes it easier to figure out what the exact steps are, what the different experiences might be to get there.
Yeah, I agree. You know, I think even just having an idea of like what I want to spend my even volunteer time on, because, you know, like to put it maybe a different way, this idea of like, if you didn't have a focus, like how would you even know where to volunteer, right? How would you know who to call? And if you were going to just like, I got to do something, I don't know. I agree. I think that's really interesting.
Yeah.
I think for me, the most interesting part of the talk for me is just the constant comparison to his job into my job, and like thinking like, oh, okay, he's going to go take some data, then he's going to make a report, then he's going to, you know, bring that to the manager, quote unquote manager. And then he's going to, you know, kind of adjust, do some different testing, quite a bit of travel, but travel. And but then you think this is for like an intense sports team. It's like engineering athletics. Like I don't know. It's just constantly like hearing, it's interesting to hear that his day to day is so engineering, but then like, just be kind of taken aback by this idea of it's this huge sports team.
Yeah, engineering athletics. I like that term. Like he's the athlete of the engineering world. He has this regiment of how his week's going to go. He has to prepare, get everything ready, and then hand it off on race day. It goes. And I guess, race day, we think of the drivers maybe as being the athletes, but we don't always think about the people behind the driver who have supported him to get there and have their own roles. The driver may be the quarterback, if we want to use football terms, but you know, the rest of the team is everyone supporting him, and they're just as important.
Right. Yeah. This is the constant, you know, analogies, even just like looking at tape, you know, and just kind of all these things. It's just, yeah, the engineering athlete. It's really cool. Right. Yeah. I really enjoyed that conversation.
Yeah, I'm glad we got to talk to him. I don't, I have a coworker who works in racing now, but hasn't been in it that long. So it was really interesting to hear about someone who has been doing it for a while and got to do it right out of college and living the dream.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, buddy. Well, you know, hope you enjoy your night and we'll be in touch soon.
All right. Good luck. Good luck at school, Troy.
Oh yeah. One day at a time. It's finals week coming up. I guess. Couple weeks,
maybe you don't have to worry about it. You don't even have finals. You just get to be there and do the cool engineering stuff.
Yeah, that's kind of the weird part about being a PhD student who's passed all the exams and taken all the classes. When you're just doing research, it's, I don't know, the typical like stresses of the normal academic schedule, like of, you know, stress before finals week and stuff. Just kind of like I'm sitting there at the meetings, like, oh, okay, I'm not worried. No, whatever, because just doing my thing. But
cool stuff. Have fun. I'm going to go back to tinkering and messing around and doing cool sound stuff.
There we go. All right, nice. Everybody. Enjoy your night. See ya.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Engineer Your Career with Troy Bauman and Brennan Timrak. For more information about the show, visit our website at eycpodcast.com. There you can find show notes for each episode and get in touch with Troy and I. If you or someone you know are an engineer with an interesting or even not so interesting career journey and would like to be on the show, go on the website, send us a short bio, and we may just invite you to come on and share your story. And finally, if you want to show your support, please rate, review, like, or subscribe to the show on your podcast player of choice.